The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
From Transmitting the Light. The 35th ancestor, Great Master Shito, visited Qing Yuan. Qing Yuan asked, "Where are you from?" Shito replied, "I come from Zhaoxi." Qing Yuan then raised his Hosu and asked, "Does this exist in Zhaoxi?" Shito answered, "It is not only non-existent in Zhaoxi, but it doesn't exist in India either." Qing Yuan asked him, "You haven't been to India yet, have you?" Shito said, "If I went, it would exist." Qing Yuan said, "That's not good enough. Say more." Shito replied, "Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me." Qing Yuan said, "I don't refuse to speak to you, but I am afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened." Shito said, "It's not that it will not exist, it's just that no one will be able to express it." Qing Yuan hit him with the Hosu, and Shito was greatly awakened. Keizan comments, "With one raising of the Hosu, he held up the totality of the way. Never by so much as a hair did Shito ever deviate from it." So this is the fairy tale we have been looking into this week. One of the many stories passed down to us, stories told so long ago, stories told in halls illuminated by flickering candles. And people just like us sitting in those halls, hearing stories, telling stories, looking into the great matter. These koan stories are part of the our distinct heritage as a Zen community. And there are many collections. There are some that we have put together, well, that have been put together and handed to us, to me and Melissa, and now to Alan and Michael, as this way to help navigate. And of course, it's not really to navigate. One of the shadow sides of koan practice, the way we do it, is that you think you are getting somewhere. And of course, there's nowhere to get to. So in the formal koan practice, you work with one, you memorize it, you come to the teacher, and the teacher will ask you certain questions, ask you to make a demonstration of what you're understanding or to talk about it. And then the teacher will accept your answer or not, suggest looking someplace else. This happens all the time, you find your way through. And we say, and you may say, you have passed this koan. But we're lying. You haven't passed anything. You have entered in, maybe dipped your toe in the water, but all of these koans, are endlessly illuminating. And this particular one from the transmission of the light is actually a koan I went through in my training, but until Alan suggested we use this for the koan this week, I had no recollection of this particular one. It's not one that made a deep impression on me. But here we are looking into it, looking into this story of a young student who studies with one teacher and then goes to another teacher, goes and has conversations and we assume lived with and worked with side by side. The great opportunity of our sesshin is not listening to Dharma talks, although I have been so delighted and amazed by all the talks given. And it's not going to Doksan. Of course, a wonderful, essential part. But being here, living here, walking together, doing this elaborate dance we call sesshin. And earlier we read Hungjar cultivating the empty field. This empty field, and there is a field here in the Zendo, the field, the Sangha field, we might say. From the outside or from a relative perspective, we could say, oh, there are so many people sitting on cushions and we could count them and, you know, do all kinds of things to identify these life forms on the cushion. Although we could not identify all the life forms within those life forms on the cushion, all the microbes and everything else living inside you. You, of course, are only very partially yourself. You belong to your gut biome as much as your gut biome belongs to you. We are dependent on all the living things. But anyway, we sit here in some ways as individuals, but we sit here as one Sangha, one body. And this field of the Zendo, the field of Sangha, is like the ocean, has all kinds of weather conditions. Sometimes the ocean can be so calm, you might think, oh, a lovely ocean, I think I'll go out in my little boat and let myself be supported. But then the next day, or maybe that afternoon, a thunderstorm comes in and high waves and wind crash on the shore. And you and your little boat better stay on the land. Or you and your little boat turn over and you fall to the bottom of the ocean. Like that here as we play in the field of emptiness. And emptiness not in the sense that there is nothing here, but emptiness in the sense that nothing can be distinguished. Everything is fully, effortlessly functioning part of something larger. And the teaching that is happening in this Zendo is happening moment after moment. As you sit right where you are, as you sit in the middle of your whole life of coming and going, each one of us here has devoted ourselves in some genuine way, not just here this week, but leading up to this week, each one of us has looked into this matter and come back again and again for reasons only partially understandable by us. But we sit here and you present yourself because you have nothing else to present. You present yourself because you run out of things you think you should be, or you run out of your competence, or maybe even you run out of your anxiety or your fear. I would be anxious, but I'm too tired. I have nothing left. And so we all break down, we all melt down, every one of us. And the axle falls off, and the wheel falls off, and the muffler starts to make noise, and we're a rambling wreck, each one of us, barely getting through the round and dragging ourselves around behind Will. Oh, Will, stop going. Can't you clap so we can sit? Oh, but I don't want to sit. Keep going. And we lose track of who's who. And in this losing track, Sun Sanim sometimes said, only don't check, right? We're usually constantly checking, how was I, how am I, how will I be? But at some point, we can no longer do this. And we simply walk, we simply sit. And in every moment before and after, in every moment you are teaching, you are giving the impossible gift of yourself. You are presenting the Dharma. All of these Dharma talks constantly, each one of us. But as Yunmen said, as I mentioned last night, you cannot listen to your own Dharma talk. You know, we would like to know, who am I? What is this? What is this light? If you try to see it, you cannot. And so we have to sit and move into our life and move into our practice on faith. If we check to make sure it's going to be okay, we're already mountains and rivers block our way. So we are demonstrating our practice is very active. Do nothing, Lin Shi said. So we are doing nothing. And in this doing nothing, we are intimately connected to each other. An astonishing and inexplicable togetherness happens here in the Zendo, each one of us alone. Each one of us alone, and yet each one of us part of this fabric, coming and going, this fabric of that's constantly shape-shifting. So this is part of the teaching, this Zazen. For 15 years I sat with my main teacher, George Bowman, retreat after retreat, often simply in people's homes, small groups, 8, 10, 12, we would sit and we would sit. Not a flashy kind of practice, but we all were learning from each other. So I hope we learn from the words of our teachers, of each other. More than this, I hope that we can learn to open our hearts and to receive the deep teaching, which is the presence of each other, and to begin to imagine, if only for a moment, that our presence might be the fullness. Your presence as you have been, your presence not after you calm down, not after you get a personality makeover, but the fullness of you, the anger, the resentment, the pride, the hiding, the conniving, all of this, is here. As Keizan said from the very beginning, not a hair. Never by so much as a hair did Shito ever deviate from the way. So not passing koans, and of course there's this curriculum of koan, but the real koan, your real koan, that sometimes comes in the form of the one you happen to be working on, is the real koan is you. Your miserable self, your unworkable life, incorrigible. And I think each one of us is a hopeless case. You are hopeless, I am hopeless, because you will never be, I will never be who I think I should be. And thank goodness, I am so glad you are not who you would like to be. You would be insufferable. We would all be. But somehow in the fullness, in the brokenness, in the limp that each one of us walks with, is some gift of wholeness beyond light and dark, beyond this and that, beyond life and death. And so this koan of ourself, we can notice that comes in and out of focus, we might say. There are times, I think for all of us, and maybe brief times, but times when there's no problem. Maybe moments during sesshin, some kind of ease and calm. And in your life, moments maybe just sipping your tea and reading the New Yorker, where there's no problem. And then other times, maybe later that same day or the next morning, you're sure that you are the problem, and that you've tried so hard and nothing has worked, and look how terrible everything is. So we could say, we might say about the koan of your life, that it comes in and out of resolution. You will never fully resolve the koan of your life because you are living it. It is active and alive, and the understanding that you get about yourself will break down. All the insights that we might carefully write down after retreat. Okay, what I learned is this, and we might put it on a piece of paper on the door, or some great quote that is so inspiring. But all of these insights, all of these quotes have a shelf life. And after a while, the quote that was so moving, the word, the approach gets to be a little stale and kind of dull, and then gets stinky if you hold on to it. Eventually the paper falls down, you put it in the recycling. But whatever comes into realization will fall apart. Buddha said all compound things fall apart. You and I are falling apart. Melissa asked me the other day how the garden, the temple garden is, and I said, oh, it's a wreck, it's just falling apart. Right? Leaves falling, branches falling, weeds growing. I've had the great privilege of spending Samu period out in the garden, and I look at some little area and maybe I trim a bush or I move some little plant from here to there, and I look down and I think, good, the garden is perfect now. And then I turn around and find something else. And I think it's what I love about gardening, perhaps more than anything else, is that it's never done. There's always something calling. Some corner of the garden that is the next koan. What to do in this place where the bunnies come and everything Michael and I put in there, the bunnies come the next night and say, thank you so much. And they eat our beautiful echinacea flowers right down to the nub. Yum, yum. Love that echinacea. What to do there? The light and the shade, everything is a koan. And for a little while, little parts of the garden, the koan comes into resolution. Now this and now that. But of course, only temporary. So this koan that we have been looking into, for me so rich, Shito coming. I think I want to close by reading and saying just a few words about Keizan talking about Shito. Yesterday we spent a little bit of time running down to Shito. What a prideful young whippersnapper he was. Shito reminds us, he says, thus, if you investigate fully and completely and reach that place Shito reached in the beginning, reach that place where Shito reached in the beginning, where the whole body is exposed alone, you will understand that there is nothing at Shaoxi or India. Is this at Shaoxi or India? Shito says, no. There is no Zen. The emperor asked Bodhidharma, what is the essential teaching of Zen? He says, vast emptiness, nothing holy. This wonderful and necessary breaking down and seeing that there is nothing to hold on to. And of course, this is not the final place. Seeing the absolute is not yet enlightenment, Shito later said. So essential to look into the matter, to sit for long hours, to give yourself to come up against that iron wall, the iron wall of you and what you have constructed, and to do this with others and to fall apart and fall apart, to die again and again, to give away whatever you have, give away your whole life in each breath. And when we do this, and when this work, because you cannot do this, but the Dharma is working on you exactly right. The timing of your life is exactly right. Thank goodness you took that left turn 20 years ago instead of the right turn. Otherwise, you would not be here. Always exactly here. And the demonstration is bowing when the bell rings. The demonstration is standing in line, waiting to go in and eat our delicious food. The demonstration is your stillness in the heat and in the cold, in the understanding and in the not understanding, in the coming together and the falling apart. Never for a moment have you been astray. Thank you. Let's arrange the zendo for our Dharma dialogue and sit comfortably. Yeah, Deb.
Thank you, David. So in Sesshin, in the kitchen, I feel like very loving towards...
A little louder, Deb. A little louder.
Oh, I feel loving towards, you know, washing the rice and chopping the apples and, you know, deciding what we're having and the whole thing. And I feel this calmness. But then in life, it doesn't feel the same. You know, I think I'm going from one thing to the other instead of being with the thing I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So I think you were kind of addressing that. But so I just feel like it's, you know, going, life is different, and that transition from session to life. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, he keeps saying life, as if this isn't
life. Yeah, this is life, yeah.
Right. So it's part of the work, part of the play of being a Zen practitioner, person of the way, is to first notice the categorization error that you might be doing. To keep using the word life is very interesting, right? To see that the whole thing is life. So here at Sesshin, yeah, things maybe are simpler. But how could we perceive the difference? You know, when I used to have to travel to Sesshin, I don't really have to anymore. Going to the train station or the plane, and it's suddenly all this stuff, it's coming at me, and it seems like so much. And tomorrow we'll hear from Jenny about how to make that transition more peaceful. But ultimately, it's life in just these different forms. And you can make a choice, once you see how you're separating, to bring everything back together again. I've had the best conversations of my life with people I buy tickets from at the train station. Right? It's life. It's sort of like Sesshin leaking into the rest of my life, what we sometimes call our daily life, maybe, right? But it's all life.
And also, I think you bring up the fact that at some point this Sesshin will be ending. As much as we've all devoted to being here, that's in the field now. Mm. You know, when we start, it's like, oh, this is probably going to go on forever. and so now the mind is, you know, like the horse heading for the barn door. So notice that. It's what begins to happen. But yet an eternity left here. And to practice being more present in your life, practice being more present in your life. and that longing, so the opportunity here in this last day is not to make really good plans for when you get home, right? Yeah. That's a getting lost in it. The opportunity is to really embody it in every, you know, in the kitchen, on the chair, wherever we are. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Now, I do want to say one more thing about it, just coming from my own experience. These making plans, you know, we all do them. Oh, I'm going to change my life. And, you know, we always say put it off because the mind goes to this place. But one of the things that happens when I make this transition from Sushin life to daily life is because I'm used to stopping and saying, what is this? I'll start wrapped up in stuff, you know, like we do, and emails, and people, oh my goodness, not just the person who bought the train ticket from, but my family. And so to pause and see where I'm complicating things is really interesting, that we actually can make changes, can make choices. We don't know how the future is going to unfold. We really don't. So we have to keep meeting each moment like we meet each moment in our practice. So it's kind of exciting. And it's disappointing if you're kind of stuck in purity, like Sashin, and daily life. But if you realize, it's all life. It's like, oh, what's this now? What's this now? Yeah, how could I make a different choice?
To look at this stuff that we keep in check most of the time. So it causes us discomfort and misery in our lives, but hidden, now seen clearly.
Yeah, I love this. Our good selves are all breaking down. And we're so devoted to what we think of as our good self, you know, not the problem. You know, I'm gonna, when it does break down, it's very disturbing. It's not philosophical at all. It's like this is no fun. But you're right. Such a precious opportunity. You know, we've spent a lifetime trying to manage ourselves and to check ourselves and make sure, you know, that's there and this is here. And in this breakdown, and it's so embarrassing, you know, for me, the breakdown when the parts of me leak out that I you know, have worked so hard, but such an opportunity. Yeah.
You know, this this only don't check. It's a beautiful little line, because for me it's when an activity, say sanu, it's not like there's a self sitting there twirling its thumbs waiting to check, or all bummed out that it can't check. It's just clipping the vines and just scrubbing the toilet. And then, you know, you don't even have to check that there's someone checking. It's just the activity complete mm-hmm. in itself.
Yeah. Thanks. Will.
I guess I have a question about idealization, sort of retroactive, right? It can sort of, one experience can be that you transition from sesshin life to daily life, and then suddenly, or slowly, you think, daily life needs to be more like sesshin life. That's what I learned. Sesshin life is great. Sesshin life is really, you know, everything is smooth and mm-hmm. perfect, and then that becomes a delusion of its own, right? Because it just accentuates yeah. the difference
yeah.
rather than the continuity. So that yeah. seems to me to be something to work with for
yeah.
myself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Right. Well, we and in a sense, Zen is built on a mythic past. That the Tang mm. Dynasty, the great masters in the Tang Dynasty, did not occur till the next dynasty, 200 or 300 years later. There were individuals and there was Zen in the Tang Dynasty,
yeah.
but this golden age was created not in 7th, 8th, 9th century. So you can have a good retreat, even if it's been miserable. You can have a great retreat next week. Oh, that was a good one. but this story making, we can have a great yesterday or think yesterday was good and today isn't. And so we can practice non-idealization or recognizing it. Oh, yeah, that's that. By this simple means of coming back and then letting go of whatever we had. So you had a great retreat, big deal, right? So you had a great, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Or so you had a terrible one, big deal. Here it is.
And there's this possibility, too, that we get home and we realize, wow, my daily life at home is way more like sesshin than I thought. You know, in a sense, this goes back to what Deb brought up. You know, well, what if we go home and we still love making the food and, you know, we still love cleaning up.
Mm-hmm.
That too can happen. And so not deciding in advance that it's going to be some kind of a fall from mm-hmm. our little Zen paradise. But we may find that we were living there all along.
And we may find that people still irritate us. Probably not, but it may happen. Yeah.
Well, and you know, this is one of the reasons why we have begun offering so many sesshin. Because if we go home and we think, oh, sesshin, the paradise of sesshin, and then we sign up for the next one because we're so excited to replicate. Boy, within 24 hours, knees are hurting, we're mm-hmm. tired, we're mm-hmm. not getting enough to sleep, we're not getting to do what we think we should do with our lives. And so being actually in sesshin, being in daily life, de-idealizes both
mm-hmm.
conditions. Mm-hmm. It's just one moment after the other.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Thank you. Orna?
Thank you, David.
Yeah.
Your last line resonated a lot, that you've never gone astray.
Mm.
What a powerful thing. I think particularly as I get older, you know, seeing the truth of the life that I've lived, but there's still those parts that have only
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done that, or because I've all these structures and patterns, I've done that, and so much judgment, you know,
mm-hmm.
so much judgment, and it's just powerful to think of that, no, never astray, and I suppose it's kind of a lovely image of the obstacles or the mountains and the rivers. That's quite a cozy image in a way, because
yeah.
sometimes the obstacles aren't so,
pile of shit and
and yet framing it with the mountains and rivers is quite lovely too. And a kind of a sense for me of, you know, there is work to be done. And before it was always like, there's work to be done, you haven't got it, you know. And now it's, oh yeah, there is. I had a glimmer of joy around that. I can't say that lingers all the time, but the amazing thing of, yes, there's life. Yeah, there is.
Well, this is Katagiri Roshi saying, let us practice for 1,000 kalpas with great joy.
Yeah.
Right? This is me. Oh, there's garden work to be done. Right? Not, there's garden, you know? But yeah, this is never astray. And there's work to be done. What a joyful day.
This is something that came up in our residency, and I can't remember if it was first week or second week when you were already with us, but, you know, mountains and rivers block your way. Great. Where's my hiking stick? And let's go. You know, what a beautiful opportunity.
A little bit going back to what Ray was saying, you know, these parts of ourself. What a great opportunity. Another thing I've been trying to manage, I don't have to anymore. Thanks. Jenny.
Somewhere in there you were saying, like, you with all your faults and flaws and just be grateful you're not the person you wanted to be. And I get that about the world. I get, be grateful that other people aren't who I wanted them to be, and the weather's not the way I wanted it to be, and everything. I get that, but it's different when it's me. So I guess I'm not that self another the same yet.
Can you speak about what the difference is? What are you noticing about yourself? Maybe it's obvious, but just say a little more.
Well, I mean, just the way I think about the world not being the way I would have it is that that's such a drab little world. That it's predictable. And there's no mystery in it or anything. And then, I mean, I'm not going to name all my flaws, or but I mean, kind of the same thing, right? I don't want to be like some cartoon character.
Well, you know, thank you for elucidating that for us. When you said that in your talk, Dave, I suddenly had this picture come up right away of like the perfect Zendo. Everybody's bald.
Thank you.
Shiny, the lights are bouncing up, and everybody's wearing their robes exactly right and sitting upright and still. And what did you say about the world? The
drab.
That's kind of drab. You know, there's there's drab little Jenny, and there's also drab little world. It's there's nothing there. It's the purity delusion.
Yeah, and it's like a video game or something.
Yeah, it's not real.
Right? It's not as good as real.
Yeah, you can't touch things in quite the same way. You can't experience things.
And when you say you can see your flaws, you can't. You have such an infinitesimally small picture of who you are and your so-called flaws. And to make a judgment on yourself based on that tiny, tiny little picture is a complete loss in a fiction.
So this was a big thing. To have said that and for me to have heard it.
good. The other side of this, though, is that you're already the person you would dream of being. You are already that. It shines through your eyes, in the way you walk and the way you move. It is undeniable. You just don't know it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Bix, you had.
Yeah, sort of one of the things that, and this idea of like non-idealization sort of brought this up for me is like, I totally idealize things. There's like a long time. I mean, it comes and goes. I don't know if it's ever going to stop. But there's part of me that really idealizes like monastic life, which is not an easy way to live. And I know that. It's mm-hmm. like you're getting this amount of sleep during the normal time, and then the shave is like even less. And it's just kind of inspiring to sort of discover, like, I don't know, I have teachers who have like made this their life without having to be like tucked away in like a rural area in the woods somewhere, and sort of being able to work with you know, daily life, not making such a distinction between formal Zen daily life and informal Zen daily life.
And those nice shiny bald heads, you know, get eczema on them, and the sangha. Among the sangha, there are intense jealousies and resentments that last for decades, and you know, people that want to trip people up. You don't, you know, the real monastery is just as screwed up as a place you would want to be, and so, you know, we get de-idealized for you pretty quickly if you spend a couple of years in one. I would imagine, having not spent that much time in monasteries, but knowing something from talking to people that have been in them and read accounts.
And there are dreams, you know, so often I think we can think of idealization as the dream, well, I dream this and that, but yet each one of us has to follow something. You know, what is it that calls to us? And then we get to try it out. We get to do it, and not believing, you know, it's just going to be worse, you know, it's just or it's going to be better when, you know, that really prevents you from living your life. Mm-hmm. But noticing which are the images or the dreams or the longings that keep come back and back, and then you head off, and it may be exactly the wrong direction, and it's not a problem. Right, just, yeah, 100% into it. Not that. But we don't know until we follow and notice. Yeah.
And dreams can be more complex. They don't just have to be dreams of paradise and dreams of perfection. On Monday, this coming Monday, we're going to celebrate the 15th anniversary of David and I making this crazy decision to buy this building and land. We had no money. We just did it. Luckily, things worked out. But before it happened, months before, if not years before, I had a dream, an actual dream, of being dressed in robes like this, walking down a brick pathway to a little gazebo. I'd never seen this place. So there's some way that, is that dream being enacted now? Well, I kind of have to say, yep, it is. But I couldn't have, I don't know if I had aimed directly at it, I don't think it would have happened. And I didn't do it myself, right? That it was all these karmic causes and conditions coming together. People doing things that appeared to be mistakes. And then here we are, right now. How amazing. 15 years in this place. And Alan was reminding me, we bought the place in August, and we had our first sushi in here in October. We built the beds, and we, you know, we did everything. And David and I were very lucky. Somebody came along and bought our old house, so we didn't lose everything. But it's just like, I don't know, you have to take one step at a time. But the dreams also are important. Accompanying this, making things juicy and not drab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rich, last one.
So with all the pathos and encouragement talks, there's one, maybe in the first week, but that puzzled me that I don't remember being addressed, which is the vast inconceivable source can't be faced and can't be turned away from. That can it, I mean, that could be a whole taste show, but does anybody have a little bit to say about that?
Well,
like, why can't you face it? I kind of get the other part.
What's your experience with that? Trying to face it or turn away from it?
I guess I'm not sure what the vast inconceivable source is.
What do you imagine it is? When you hear those words, what pops up into your head?
It's not a thought, which is unusual for me.
That's cool. Keep going.
Something kind of boundless, you know, a lot of light.
Yeah. How do you face it or turn away from it if it's boundless?
That's interesting. I could see trying to turn away from it.
Yeah, and how's that work for you?
Well, I close my eyes. I don't know.
But if you you really know this already, that's the cool thing. Whenever there's something that sticks that we don't understand, you know. And actually, Esther gave a talk on it last night. She I don't know if you heard the reference.
You read it.
Yeah, but
you didn't talk about it directly. But
I'm not. I don't want to go back in time and dissect that.
Right.
But the thing is, you already know what this is, and you just named it beautifully. Right? If it's vast, and if it's inconceivable,
right,
it could it be everywhere? And so how can you turn away or face it?
Thank you.
So you already knew that. That's why you could say, thank you.
Yeah.
I didn't know I knew it.
Well, that's the point of Zen teaching altogether. You all know this stuff, but it just needs to be pointed out, framed. It's kind of amazing.
You know, often we use this word boundless, but we forget to include ourselves.
Well, let's dive back in.